You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to our second of two podcasts on metastatic non-small cell lung cancer hosted by Med Learning Group entitled Personalized Medicine for Metastatic Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer, Leveraging Immune Competence. This series was designed to meet the educational needs of global medical oncologists, oncology nurses, pharmacists, nurse practitioners, and other members of the multidisciplinary team in the community setting to maintain an up-to-date understanding of the latest data on immune checkpoint inhibitor or ICI-based regimens in the management of NSCLC. My name is Kim Farina, a medical director for Med Learning Group, and I will be the host of today's podcast. In this episode, we'll talk about how to help patients with advanced metastatic NSCLC get through their ICI-based therapy as safely and efficaciously as possible. Joining me today is Dr. Edward Guerin, Professor of Medicine in Hematology Oncology at Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA in Los Angeles. Dr. Guerin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So in our last podcast, we talked about ICIs and their role in the treatment of advanced metastatic NSCLC. Can you walk us through some of the primary safety concerns associated with the use of ICI monotherapy, dual ICI blockade, and ICI plus chemotherapy?
Sure. So immune checkpoint inhibitors really can lead to inflammation and therefore really damage of really any tissue in the body. The most common is thyroid abnormalities. Fortunately, those tend to be things that that really can be overcome by medications that are low toxicity. There are medications that really can substitute for the thyroid gland, although that obviously in the world of endocrinology for otherwise healthy patients, this is something that can be a problem compared to lung cancer. Most patients and practitioners are certainly willing to have a patient need to be on thyroid medications. The one that has been the most dreaded has been pneumonitis or inflammation in the lungs. This, as you can imagine, is a particular problem in patients with cancers of the lung. Whether or not it's specifically because the cancer is there or the fact that sort of by definition, these patients tend to have more compromised lungs, often also associated with substantial smoking histories. And certainly in early clinical trials, there was a low but real death rate from pneumonitis. And we unfortunately do still see some patients who will succumb to pneumonitis. My personal bias is that's gotten a little bit better as we've understood the toxicities of immunotherapy, but I don't have solid data to back me up on that. But I do think as people have understood it, it has improved. There are other things that are less common that we see, particularly endocrine abnormalities that included adrenal insufficiency. Sometimes people even get panhypopituitarism. These are certainly things that can have a profound impact on patients' quality of life. And, sort of a more traditional type 1 type of diabetes also can be an issue. And at least anecdotally, my bias is that has been a very difficult diabetes to manage for someone to develop sort of a sort of more traditional type 1 diabetes adulthood and often late adulthood with all the comorbidities that are typically seen in patients with non-small cell lung cancer or lung cancer in general. The one sort of unique toxicity that I would say we've generally seen when adding chemotherapy to immunotherapy that was somewhat unanticipated is particularly with the pemetrexed-based regimens, we have seen some renal dysfunction. And that can be quite substantial, can often lead to interruption or and really discontinuation of the immune checkpoint inhibitor and Generally, the other chemotherapies, which is of course difficult because these people had, lung cancer to start, and so this is certainly of some concern. Obviously, the traditional toxicities of of chemotherapy are also going to be there, but those are sort of toxicities we tend to know. Dual checkpoint inhibition, and when we're talking about that, at least in the current armamentarium in lung cancer, we're talking about combinations of a PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitor plus a CTLA-4 inhibitor. I would say the major addition there is colitis, and colitis is a particularly difficult toxicity for many patients. It is one place where we have a non-steroid medication that I think is certainly helpful. Infliximab certainly has shown to be of substantial benefit in patients with CTLA-4 inhibitor-induced colitis. Unfortunately, I would argue that for many of the other toxicities that we see, we don't have as clear data of sort of steroid-sparing or non-steroid agents that are efficacious. There are other toxicities that can be seen occasionally in CTLA-4 inhibition, and although, for instance, CNS toxicities can be seen with monotherapy, they are rare, but seen, I would argue, at higher levels in patients with immune checkpoint inhibitor dual therapies. And I think we've seen that more in trials to date, looking at small cell lung cancer, for instance.
Well, the diversity of the potential IRAEs seems daunting in terms of monitoring and management. From your perspective, what are the basics for mitigating and managing at least the most common IRAEs?
Yeah, so it's interesting. We sort of talk about the idea that this is daunting, but in reality, I would argue it's not, because the answer is almost always the same, which is steroids. Now, the in patients who have endocrine abnormalities, there you definitely can see the damage is generally done. So to give someone who has developed hypothyroidism or adrenal insufficiency or type 1 diabetes, steroids probably is not going to help. Now, obviously, the adrenal insufficiency is a unique case, whereas as replacement, you tend to give the steroids, but it's not, we're not going to see that reversing the process. Outside of that, when there's a severe adverse immune reaction, we tend to give a milligram to 2 milligrams per kilogram of a steroid, and that is something we determine basically on what our level of concern is. For instance, with pneumonitis, somebody hypoxic, certainly we would bring them into the hospital and give IV steroids. I think in practice it's always a little bit difficult because we have these sort of firm guidelines in terms of what we do with really severe adverse events, but there are certainly a group of people who have more of a persistent bothersome adverse event, and I think those still get a little bit to the art of medicine. Oftentimes, to try and avoid significant steroid doses, we'll start at a lower dose if the toxicity is not that severe. One of the things, though, that I think is really important in this for people who are managing this is to understand that, in general, that these tend to be long steroid courses. Even sometimes in the patients who maybe don't have as severe disease, that still the steroid courses tend to be long. You have to remember that the half-life of these agents is measured on the order of weeks in general. And so drug levels don't drop substantially over time. So for instance, when I'm seeing a patient in second opinion, they've been managed somewhere else, up until now, they had sort of a vague concern for pneumonitis at some point. They got a Medrol dose pack and then they stopped it. I think it's very unlikely that person had immune checkpoint inhibitor induced pneumonitis. That just isn't what we generally see. These are steroid tapers that last at least a month and often considerably longer.
I see. And so for patients that have their ICI discontinued and then maybe are on a steroid, are you continuing the chemotherapy for those patients or are they off all therapy altogether?
So it's a good question, and I think it depends a lot on what the toxicity is. So for instance, I mentioned earlier people who would have renal dysfunction from carboplatin pemetrexed and a PD-1 inhibitor. I think in those cases, it's hard to go back to those therapies because we are concerned that that really any of them can cause some renal dysfunction. But it also depends a lot on the setting, right? So this used to be, a situation where everybody getting immune checkpoint inhibitors had advanced disease. And in those cases, you obviously were going to have to go back to something. Otherwise, the patient's going to succumb to their cancer in most cases, unless somehow they'd had substantial benefit from their immune checkpoint inhibitor. And in general, we haven't necessarily seen that. I haven't, at least personally, not seen a ton of patients who got a couple doses of an immune checkpoint inhibitor, and then that was sufficient to allow them to do well over many, many years. So I think there has been a push to try and retreat people in that setting. I think where it's going to be a much more substantial hindrance to their treatment is in the early stage setting, where we start looking at, sort of a consolidation or adjuvant or neoadjuvant type approach, because there, an interruption is a little less a source of enthusiasm. What would you do, for instance, in somebody who's gotten 6 weeks of maintenance durvalumab for chemoradiotherapy and now needs to take a 2-month break, after 6 weeks? Is there value in returning to the immune checkpoint inhibitor? I think it's a little unclear. And so I think that it's going to depend a lot on the context.
So when a patient on a immune checkpoint inhibitor combination, whether it's with chemotherapy or another immune checkpoint inhibitor, when they experience a toxicity that is associated with either chemotherapy or the CTLA-4 inhibitor, how do you handle that? How do you decide what to do there?
Well, I would argue outside of the traditional cytopenias and things like that that are associated with chemotherapy, it's not always that easy to decide what is driving it. So, for instance, if someone were to have pneumonitis when they were receiving a PD-1 inhibitor or a CTLA-4 inhibitor, for instance, the question becomes, can you safely return to just the PD-1 inhibitor? And I would argue we don't know that. And we're suspicious often that we can't. So unfortunately, it is difficult to make the determination. One other thing that I think is important to note in general is that it is definitely helpful to have a team that is familiar with adverse events. We, at my institution, we have, an established team to deal with immune checkpoint inhibitor toxicity. I know that this is true at many academic centers, and I think that that should be a real consideration, even in a community setting, when you have a difficult time with an adverse event. To consider looking at academic centers. There also are increasingly clinical trials that are looking at this. Our institution is participating in one looking at cardiomyopathies that develop. And I think that's going to be essential because I think that there are a lot of things that you can do in this setting, but we don't know if they're helpful. And as I mentioned, that for CTLA-4 inhibitor-induced colitis, it's quite clear that infliximab, for instance, can lead to some benefit. I think that we have certainly seen evidence of benefit from immunosuppressants in hepatotoxicity. But there are other settings where it's not clear to me. For instance, secondary approaches in pneumonitis, you know, certainly we had some people who are in a serious, you know, difficult situation from pneumonitis who do get better after using infliximab or some other type of approach. We have patients that don't get better. It's, to me, in many of those cases, really unclear whether or not the intervention is making a difference. And I think that that this is going to be the type of question that will benefit from rigorous study to figure out what are the things that are really helping a patient improve from their toxicity versus things that are, I sometimes describe it as making us feel better that we've tried something, but not necessarily improving the patient outcome.
Another question I have is, as experience has grown with the use of ICIs in lung cancer, has your position on absolute contraindications to use of an ICI changed? For example, use of an ICI for patients with an autoimmune disorder?
So I think we have very few things we would consider absolute contraindications to an immune checkpoint inhibitor, because there aren't a lot of things where we say, well, that we're going to insist that the cancer take over. And I think, again, this is context dependent. I think that it depends a great deal on whether or not you're looking at somebody who has stage 1B disease that is very likely to be cured by surgery, maybe not very likely, I maybe misspoke, but has a reasonable chance of being cured by surgery, versus someone who has metastatic disease. There are series that have said that it is safe to treat people with autoimmune diseases at baseline, but those are going to be inherently biased results because you're much more likely to try an immune checkpoint inhibitor in someone with ulcerative colitis who's had a colectomy where the entire organ at risk has been removed than somebody for whom lupus has been their major disease that they've managed through their whole life. So I think that these are all decisions that need to be taken in a specific context. What is the potential benefit to the patient? What is the potential risk? And I think that that we don't have a lot in the way of absolute contraindications, because it's very hard to tell somebody that because, let's say they had multiple sclerosis, that you're going to say that they can't have a potentially durable response from an immune checkpoint inhibitor. But I think that the context does matter. I think if you have a non-smoker with a PD-L1 less than 1%, you're not particularly hopeful that that person is going to have long-term benefit from an immune checkpoint inhibitor. You would not tend to prioritize that sort of treatment approach, at least early in the patient's care, and maybe at any point, if they have severe rheumatoid arthritis that is life limiting to them, or at least highly symptomatic. On the other hand, that same patient with a PD-L1 of 90%, there you may very well incorporate an immune checkpoint inhibitor earlier. So I think that it again is a situation where it may give you more comfort to have a multidisciplinary team that is available at the time of toxicity. But I think that the context really does matter here.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you for that explanation. So in our last podcast, you touched on some biomarkers, emerging biomarkers in advanced lung cancer without an actionable driver mutation. There are some reports that IRAEs may be an indicator of response to an ICI. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this is actually a very difficult topic to study. And we've actually published on this. Aaron Lisberg has a publication that our group did on this from some of the earliest work. And what we found is that there was some slight improvement in outcome in patients who receive an immune checkpoint inhibitor when one does sort of an appropriately conducted study. One of the things, though, is that you do need to have an appropriately conducted study to assess this, and it is not that easy. And the reason is that toxicity data is confounded by efficacy data. And what do I mean by that? So if somebody is doing well on therapy, they're more likely to stay on drug. The longer they're on drug, the more likely they are to have an adverse event. And so in some level, sometimes having an adverse event can largely be serving as a surrogate for someone who spent a substantial amount of time on drug and basically gets rid of patients from your study who did not spend a lot of time on drug. That being said, there is some data to indicate that patients who have immune-related adverse events have a better overall outcome with immune checkpoint inhibitors. And I think that when we have looked at this, we agree that that is true, although that I would argue that most of the data you see overstates this because it doesn't address the bias of patients being on drug longer inherently being a group that has done better.
You also just mentioned the importance of incorporating a multidisciplinary team into the care for patients receiving an ICI. At a multidisciplinary academic center such as yours, maybe this is easier to accomplish than in the community setting. So do you have any advice to offer community oncologists whose patients with an IRAE may not have ready access to a specialist?
Yeah, I would argue that this is a place where you may want to consider referral to a major academic center. I think that that there are just certain sort of classes of information that benefit from being at a large hospital where people are frequently going to come in and get referred in with difficult cases. I certainly am not of the illusion that all of the really, you know, well-learned specialists are at academic centers. There are very smart people in all disciplines that are at community practices throughout the country and frankly throughout the world. One of the things that is unique is that because a place like an academic center does tend to get sort of referrals for these particularly difficult cases, there is just simply going to be more experience at these sites. And so I think that is one reason for referral in. And the other real big reason is that, again, because there are now ongoing clinical trials, hopefully as part of these trials, we'll be able to actually generate the data that can help people in a community practice, that can say, we've randomized, you know, 80 patients in this setting. And it's not going to be like a clinical study where we randomize 400 patients to each arm of a study. We're looking at situations where we randomize 60 or 80 patients to two different treatment approaches. And we can now definitively tell you, this is what you should do in your practice. At some point in a community setting, they'll be able to incorporate data that has been generated from studies at these academic centers here. But I think that it is going to be a period of time until that happens. And that's another reason to consider referral in for these. And these can be quite problematic for patients. And to address these toxicities really can be very meaningful for the patient experience.
What are your favorite resources to share with your patients when you're educating them about their therapeutic options and potential safety concerns?
Yeah, I think that that I have not necessarily used things beyond just discussions of this. I think that obviously there is a tremendous amount of literature that is available. Oftentimes, these conversations are going on at the same time that you're educating patients about the disease they have, going through all of the emotional difficulties of having a new and a very scary disease. So my experience is, even in a highly educated population of patients, which I have, that there tends to be concern about being overwhelmed by data rather than concern of insufficient amounts. And also, we also want to make sure that patients are aware of the possibility of these toxicities, but also aren't sort of freaked out by them in the sense that these are in general well-tolerated drugs. That being said, there, of course, are substantial toxicities that can occur. It's important that they be aware of those, but also, you know, you could give them a pamphlet of all of the potential adverse events, and I would describe it as sometimes if you ever read the back of a bottle of aspirin, no one would take an aspirin. They're just it can be quite scary when in fact most patients tolerate these agents quite well.
And do you let your patients know upfront when having those discussions that there is a possibility they will have to see a specialist for an immune-related adverse event to help offset any fears if that does occur later on?
I have not specifically told them about the potential for referral to a specialist because, of course, it depends a great deal on what the adverse event is. And I would say it really is the minority of people who have an adverse event who have needed to see a specialist. I would say the one that I've used the most is my hepatologist. That is one where oftentimes we haven't had as much success as we would want with the steroids, and have had to go to mycophenolate, other approaches. And I personally don't feel as comfortable managing those. I like the involvement of a specialist. Although I might argue that some of those things may come more from being part of clinical trials that have tried to intensify the immunotherapy. And I think it's less common if one is using sort of more standard of care immunotherapy approaches.
A little bit earlier, you were talking about a diabetes-like toxicity. How often is that happening? And do you usually handle that yourself or collaborate with the endocrinologist for that?
Yeah. So the diabetes is rare. It's going to be less than 1%. But it is a really rough diabetes from my perspective. So this is definitely something where we have in all cases involved an endocrinologist.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Guerin, for this very insightful conversation. I've certainly learned a lot today. And I'd like to thank our listeners for joining us. This podcast was brought to you by Med Learning Group. Med Learning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I would like to give a special thank you to our grant supporter, Regeneron, who provided an unrestricted grant for this educational activity. Have a wonderful day.